KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In a reporting for the Salt Lake Tribune, Jennifer Dobner pointed out House Speaker Greg Hughes tried to keep the commotion to a minimum as lawmakers voted on the anti-discrimination bill last week. But she says he eventually just gave up as supporters in the House gallery shouted and cheered. Dobner says the emotion in the chamber was infectious. One House clerk was so overcome, she had to have a colleague take over. Observers are calling passage of the bill historic. It extends protections to LGBT people in areas of housing development, but it also provides religious freedom protections. Today in the program, we're telling the backstory to the bill. We'll explore how it happened, how people on both sides of the simmering cultural battle are reacting to what the bill does and what it doesn't do. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's important to say that not everyone is jubilant over last week's passage of a bill in the Utah legislature that bars discrimination against LGBT Utahns and safeguards religious freedoms for churches in the state. Some religious and political conservatives believe the bill goes too far. Some in the LGBT community worry the bill doesn't go far enough. And even those who support it agree there is still work to be done. But for now, they say, what happened last week in the legislature is a net win for LGBT rights. Today in the program, we're talking about the anti-discrimination bill, exploring the backstory. We'll talk about what it does and doesn't do and what may be next in this simmering cultural battle. We invite you to join us. If you're in the LGBT community, for example, or if you're a religious or political conservative, how are you reacting to the legislation? Did it give away too much from your perspective? Do you see it as a first step or something else? 801-585-WEST is the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us first on the program is Jennifer Dobner, a reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. She covers LGBT issues. She's been following the anti-discrimination legislation this session for the paper. She's been reporting on this intersection between the LDS Church and the LGBT community for many years. And Jennifer, welcome back to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to start where you begin in your article today, that is in today's paper. You begin with the journey of Jim DeBacus, state senator now. But when he first started this process, you report, like this was two decades ago, he writes a letter to the LDS Church.
Yeah, so this is 97, 98. The Utah Pride Center is brand new, and Jim is the first chairman of the board. And he's raised Mormon, he's gay, and he writes the church leaders a letter and says, you know, let's sit down and talk. Let's get to know each other. And as he tells me, he gets a letter back that says, we just don't have anything to talk about. And then this process repeats about 6 years later when Equality Utah is founded. Yeah. He keeps going back and he keeps being politely told there's really nothing to talk about. But certainly over the last 2 weeks, we see there's a lot that they've been talking about.
It's interesting. People have been covering this issue, I have to say. They've heard about these secret meetings going on between the LGBT community and the LDS Church. I think you must be the first to publicly report on these meetings. In 2005, you mentioned five representatives of the LGBT community and the LDS Church began this series of meetings. Now, tell us a little bit about this particular part of the story.
So I don't really think it's a secret. I think it was on the down low, as they say, for a while. And this happens post Proposition 8, which is the California ballot initiative that bans gay marriage in California. That, as we know, the Mormon Church played a significant role in that. It was part of the religious coalition that worked on that issue there, and it mobilized its members across California to give money and time. And so many here felt like they had a very heavy-handed approach in passing that bill. But after that happened, and many people will recall, there was a big march around Temple Square the Friday after the California vote in 2008. A space opened up. I mean, I think I can remember being there that night of the march and thinking, This, I think, is what they mean by watershed, a moment really? From which you can't return, that in which things are going to significantly change. And so what happens after that is a group of five people from the LGBT community begin to sit down with four designated officials from the Mormon Church, and they begin what Jim calls a really awkward and difficult conversation. Yeah. They're not sure what they have to talk about. They're not sure what they have in common. But I think over time what they found out is that they did have a lot of things in common. That on the inside, you know, the hurt felt the same, and that the goals were the same for their families and for themselves as individuals. And I think what we're seeing now are the fruits of all that time at the table together.
Mormon historian Greg Prince, you talked to him. He told you that the LDS Church's involvement in Prop 8, this is what he said, he disenfranchised large numbers of church members. Are you getting any pushback from the church on that point? Or do they concede the fact that church members, some church members, according to Greg Prince, significant numbers, were not crazy about that effort?
I haven't had any particular pushback on it, and I don't know that they've ever stated that publicly. But I think if you go to social media, if you see the rise up of groups like Mormons Building Bridges, and the space that's been made for that kind of voice within the church ranks, sort of from the pews up, somebody recognizes that the membership's minds are changing, that families who once were more willing maybe to push their kids out because they were gay or not to acknowledge family members' partner relationships, that's not going to happen anymore. The wider society is moving on. The church members, of course, would move with them. Institutions do that all the time, and not just Mormons. Episcopals, Methodists, Jews, Baptists, everybody is having this conversation, and everybody is wrestling with these issues.
This is one of those things you talk about as being kind of, there are the external realities,
mm-hmm.
and you write about the internal realities, and I guess this is what you're talking about, the fact that you're hearing, that the church seems to be hearing from family members who have gay children or gay members of their family, and they're asking the church to move as far as it can, I suppose. Is that what's going on?
Well, that's what I hear from people, yes, that they're asking. Now, institutions move slowly. I think that you're not going to ever see a doctrinal shift. There was a television interview over the weekend with D. Elder Christofferson of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, where he talks about this with KUTV and says, you know,
He said nope.
He said nope to marriage,
yeah,
which is
yeah.
not a surprise. And frankly, you know, maybe you shouldn't ever give on marriage. I think principles are good. And if this is your belief, then, you know, you're well within your rights to hang on to those things. But agreeing across the spectrum of religious traditions or political beliefs, agreeing that people need housing and people need employment is actually quite easy. It doesn't shift your doctrinal position at all, but certainly it's supportive of people within your own ranks and with everyone else in the community.
Did Jim DeBacchus ever, have you ever been able to, I guess, gather from whomever you've been talking to, what was the clincher when the church finally made a decision that I think we can go with this? Do you have a sense of that?
You know, I don't, and no one's really articulated that, and certainly they have a right to the privacy of those conversations, but we see the church the turn for the first time in 2009 when the church publicly supports Salt Lake City's non-discrimination ordinance, which has similar exemptions for religious organizations. It allows them not to follow the law, essentially,
right.
Under, you know, most conditions. And then since then, you know, 19 other communities across Utah had passed similar local ordinances. This new law, Senate Bill 296, will supersede all of those.
Sure.
A statewide law never seemed to be on the table. What Elder Christofferson said over the weekend is, you know, this was the first time that they saw an intersection between adequate protections for religious liberty and rights for the gay community that didn't sort of interfere or make them give up something that they held precious. I mean, this is a conversation that's been going on as marriage laws have sort of toppled over across the country. In the last year, that number's doubled from 18 at the time that Judge Shelby made the federal court ruling here that legalized gay marriage in Utah. And October, you know, you went from 17 states to 37 and the District of Columbia. So that's moving very rapidly. And maybe institutions of faith and conservatives are looking to see for where opportunities are, where they can give a little bit but not give up everything.
Do you think you understand exactly what LDS church leaders are worried about when they talk about threatened religious liberties? I mean, what exactly are they worried about that could potentially happen if they concede that this cultural shift is happening, which it seems like they are, at least acknowledging that the realities of same-sex marriage now— What exactly are they worried about? Do you think you understand that?
Well, I would never presume to know what church member leaders are thinking. But I would suspect, and I think we've seen some of this in conversations around the country, that any religious tradition wants to hold on to what their beliefs are. The First Amendment gives you those protections. I think what we're seeing now codified in law is an extra layer of protection that says, I don't have to endorse your lifestyle if I don't agree with it. I don't have to marry people I don't want to marry. And I think anybody would defend their right to hang on to those beliefs. That's one of the cornerstones of our founding as a nation, that separation.
What were conservatives on the Hill? How are they reacting? I mean, I think for some lawmakers, this was a tough one. Their church was saying, we support this piece of legislation, but then they had their own kind of ideology, their own conscience, which was telling them something else.
Well, we did hear that on the floor. In particular, Senator Mark Madsen from Utah County said, I'm not really sure what to do here. My church is saying I should support this, but my church is also exempting itself. So that was sort of a tension for him that he was trying to work out. Other oppositions to the bill were, you know, this is going too fast.
Ken Ivory was one.
Ken Ivory was one. Yeah. And some people said it was a constitutional dive. I think that's what Ken said, actually,
right.
Is that he didn't really, he thought it had constitutional implications that hadn't been fully vetted. Religious liberty bills are not new. They've been tried in, you know, half a dozen or a dozen or more states. Some are better than others, according to legal scholars. I don't really know all the ins and outs of those particulars. But this is something different that Utah's trying to do. Some people are holding it up as a model. I don't know if you can cut and paste things from state to state, because certainly places have their unique character. But on the ground right now here in Utah, this is what people here have agreed they think can work. It protects everyone, whether you're a person of faith or you're in the LGBT community. And there is some pushback in the LGBT community about whether or not, you know, Equality Utah sold out and they let the church roll them on the issue. But I think if you look at what it does and the very practical application of this law in people's everyday lives, you can't be denied housing or tossed out of your housing for who you are. You can't be thrown out of your job because of who you are. You know, last year, or 2013, actually, when gay couples first started getting married, there was some anecdotal evidence through the internet and through, you know, kitchen table stories about people who got married over the weekend and then lost their job days later. I've never been able to verify or document that in any substantial way, but that can't happen now. And so I think it's a really big win for them. The Williams Institute out of UCLA, which studies LGBT rights across the country, found about 5 years ago that there are, based on census data and some other survey material, there are about 55,000 gay and transgender people in Utah, and about 37,000 of those are in the workforce, and well over 40% were reporting harassment at work, problems at work, losing their job at work. If you read their study, there are just some horrific stories about people being told, you know why you can't work here anymore. And it's just, you know, I think fairness matters to people here in Utah, and I think that really has been corrected by this piece of legislation.
About a minute left, I wanted to ask you finally, what do you think the next sort of, I guess, battle in this war is going to be? Is it going to be related to public accommodation? That was one thing they couldn't get through this year.
Jim DeBacchus had a public accommodation bill, which he did, he let go as part of the, you know, compromise negotiations. So I think, and that's the sort of legislation that prevents somebody from saying, you know, you can't sit at my lunch counter because I don't like who you are. That'll be the next hurdle. I think individual conscience for religious people, that was another piece of legislation that didn't advance. I don't think that issue or that conversation is going to go away. this year it was decided it wasn't really necessary, that maybe this bill took care of it.
Take what they can get?
I don't know if it's take what they can get, but I think that some felt that that, in terms of constitutional issues, went too far. There have been a number of lawsuits about that around the country. Bakers, photographers, whomever, have tried to say, I'm not going to provide services. That didn't fly this year here. Whether or not we get to it next year, we'll have to see.
Final quick question. Jim DeBacchus, and I think others are saying this, that the Prop 8 battle that the Mormon Church was engaged with turned out to be a blessing in disguise. Are you hearing that? That it turned out pretty well for them in
that
sense? Well,
I think it really did truly create a space in which people were talking to each other for the first time. And I think what's really important about what happened this session is that the LGBT community, which oftentimes did not have a voice at the political table, now does. And that will forever change sort of the course of the future for them, because when Brad Dee got up on the floor to introduce the bill in the House and said, in all my years in the legislature, I never met with the LGBT community. And this is, it's my 16th year in Utah, and it seems like in every one of those years we've had some either anti-gay bill or religious liberty bill. To think that someone never, who's been there that whole time, had never met with them, this is so significant that now he's the person on the floor of the House, you know, pushing this legislation. So huge steps were made forward for the LGBT community that maybe not are as tangible as some people would like, but I think they will make a difference as we go forward.
Jennifer Dobner, reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll put a link to her piece in today's paper. Jennifer, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure, always.
We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are exploring sort of the backstory of the LGBT anti-discrimination bill that made its way through this year's legislative session. The clincher for the bill, of course, which had languished for years, was the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which surprised a lot of people when it announced its support for that legislation. The process involved careful negotiations between the church and the LGBT community. We're talking about the give and take in that process. Clifford Roski is joining us now on the program, a law professor at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. He's also chairman of the board of Equality Utah. He's in Washington, D.C. today, joining us from the studios of the Brookings Institution there. And Professor Roski, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. It's a pleasure.
I guess let's start with your general reaction. I mean, on balance, you take this, of course, as a win. It's a good thing, the legislation that was passed last week.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a very important step, as Jennifer said. And I think it's important to remember that it's not just the intangible or cultural signal that it sends, but there are real tangible benefits. You know, there's nothing intangible about being unemployed or homeless. There are really important, meaningful, and equal protections afforded by this law to some of the most vulnerable Utahns.
Let me ask you, there were moments when it seems like, I think, you thought things could have gone differently or certainly not have gone your way in some cases. There was a kind of reaction to 296. There was a 297. There were other bills. And I think you really worried that they could have been kind of worst case scenario.
Oh, absolutely. It's important to remember where we began this session when Representative LeVar Christensen introduced a bill known as House Bill 322, which offered no protections to gay and transgender Utahns, and yet at the same time used the banner of religious liberty to drive a truck through our state's civil rights laws. It would have really destroyed protections for racial and religious minorities while not giving anything to the LGBT community. And, you know, Equality Utah and the ACLU of Utah and other organizations worked very hard to ensure the defeat of that bill.
You said one of your concerns was that one of those bills would have traded protections for LGBT people, but in the end that didn't happen, which was a significant win, I guess. So the compromise was give us a sense of that. It gives protections to LGBT people as employees and people of faith. They get protections as employees. Is that the crucial language, at least for this piece?
Well, there's also housing in here, too. So it's renters and home buyers, right? So I think the key point here is that there was no new exemption for religious individuals or a kind of Hobby Lobby type exemption for businesses that are owned by religious individuals or families inserted into the law. Rather than trading protections for exemptions, as I think many people would have expected in this law, what we did was add new protections for, as you said, employees who are both LGBT and people of faith. In particular, there are new protections that apply to employees when they are outside of the workplace. So the classic example here would be if you donated in support of Proposition 8 or you donated against Proposition 8, in either case, your employer can't fire you because of making that donation. That's a new protection that protects both sides quite equally.
Senate Bill 297, we're having a question from John in Senate. I don't think he's on the phone anymore, but he wanted to know whether Senate Bill 297, if in some ways that could nullify some of the protections in Senate Bill 296 that passed.
So in its original draft, and I think unintentionally, Senate Bill 297 did seem to provide a defense to 296, but we were very grateful. Of course, Equality Utah did not participate in the drafting of 297 in any way. But once we saw the law, of course, we were quite concerned that it might erode or destroy the protections in 296. And so we approached the sponsor, Senator Adams, and he was very good about working with us to alleviate those concerns. And you know, while it wasn't our bill, we were very happy with where the bill ended up. There's a lot of misunderstanding about the pre-existing law and how it changes it, but county clerks have never had a duty to perform marriages. They have to give out the licenses,
right,
but they don't have to perform the civil ceremonies, and that's still true. But what this bill does ensure is that if they won't marry anyone who walks in the door and obtains a license, then they'll have to designate someone else who will perform all marriages. So the county clerks have made it quite clear that they will not be picking and choosing which marriages to perform. The law doesn't permit that. They must treat all couples equally.
There was an op-ed in Friday Salt Lake Tribune. LGBT activist Eric Etherington said in that piece that the bill that passed contained what he believed was a Trojan horse. He says giving protections to individuals to express anti-LGBT religious views may seem small, but he argues that the religious rights national agenda only needs a foot in the door to get what he says is the ball rolling for larger religious exemptions. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think there's a couple really important things to understand. In that article, the author describes this single sentence as an individual religious exemption, and that's really just a misunderstanding of the line. There are no exemptions for religious individuals in the law whatsoever. There are exemptions for religious organizations and for the Boy Scouts. The exemptions for religious organizations were there before. They've been clarified, but you know, there are simply no exemptions for religious individuals. The author seems to be referring to this one sentence that simply says that employers must treat the religious speech of an employee as they treat the other speech of employees. As long as it's reasonable, it's not disruptive, and it's not harassing, it has to be treated on equal terms with any other speech that the employer allows. That's frankly just a restatement of existing protections under federal and state law. It might even be weaker than existing protections, mm-hmm. but it does send an important symbolic message. It's certainly not a new protection or a Trojan horse, unless, of course, you know, some people take the position that compromise or balance in this area, indeed, equality among people of faith and LGBT people is simply inappropriate. Of course, we don't take that position. But of course, you know, we respect other people's right to disagree.
That's a big question, though, you know, the question of whether or not same-sex marriage and religious liberty are inherently compatible. Have you come to the conclusion they are now?
Well, at least in some areas, certainly in employment and housing, I think we've achieved a big victory here. For the most part, religious people of faith were already protected by existing anti-discrimination laws, and those protections have been clarified, but I don't think they've changed a great deal. But to include gay and transgender Utahns within those protections is just a step of massive importance to the community. It's only one step. Right. As you said earlier, the law doesn't address public accommodations. That was a disappointment. It's certainly something that we're deeply committed to working on, you know, as soon as possible. It's also, I think, important for folks to remember, this is a milestone, but it's not a model. There are many features of Utah law that really are quite unique because of the church's history in founding the state. The exemptions for religious organizations are broader than any other state in the country.
So,
and they were before the law.
So as Jennifer Doebner was talking about, whether or not you could cut and paste this into another place, that might not be so easy.
Oh, I think there's no question that you can't. That is to say, no other state would permit churches to discriminate based on race under its state laws or disability or age or things like that. That's a unique feature of Utah law that is not consistent with the laws of any other state or federal law.
One of the things that you and other members of the LGBT community have been talking about is that you don't really see much point in questioning the LDS Church's motivation for participating in all of this. I mean, you say they've acted in good faith. For now, that seems like enough. But, I mean, are you acknowledging that motivation is complicated, that they were motivated in part by internal pressure, by, you know, by some backlash over the Prop 8 situation as well?
I don't remember acknowledging that. Honestly, this is not a specific question for me. I always assume that other people are acting in good faith because I want them to assume that I'm acting in good faith.
Right.
And the nice thing is, as I understand it, you have a spokesperson for the LDS Church joining you after me, so I'm sure he'd be delighted to talk about what their motivations are. But, you know, this is just a matter of equal respect and dignity for other people's views. If people tell me they believe something's the right thing to do, I believe them.
Seems like such an obvious question, which is, what was the LDS Church's influence, obviously, in the passage of this? Everyone says, of course, it was the clincher, the game changer. Does that seem fairly obvious to you? Or do you think in some way there was also the fact that same-sex marriage is, that whole question, the whole legal question related to that, is changing too? I mean, do we have to plug all of that into the fact that the church is participating?
Well, we really have to look no deeper than what the legislature tells us. Last year, we proposed a bill much like this one to add sexual orientation and gender identity to our employment and housing laws, and the legislature rejected it because they said there was a marriage lawsuit pending, and that was the excuse that they offered for not passing the law. That lawsuit has been resolved, and the law has passed, so there's that. And in terms of the church's influence, as Jennifer said, when Representative D stood up, he actually... I mean, it was a fairly explicit reference to the church's endorsement. He said, I'm going to call on you to rely on your faith, not only in me, but in institutions outside these four walls. Mm. And many legislators invoked the church's endorsement in the debates over this law. So there's just no question that it had influence, which is not surprising, given that the church founded the state and most Utahns remain members.
The law now, as signed by the governor, allows employers to have these separate restrooms for men and women, but it also allows for reasonable restroom access for people who are transgendered. A person's gender identity has been plugged into this. Did that surprise you that you were able to get that part into this piece of legislation?
Equality Utah has always insisted on equal protections for both gay and transgender Utahns. We would never support any legislation that protected one group and not the other group. And of course, we thought that it was important that if there be any language about separate restrooms for males and females, that it be very clear that an employer must accommodate all employees based on their gender identity, not the sex that they were assigned at birth. And so that was very important language to us to include, the question of both in terms of dress codes and bathrooms, that a transitioning employee would be able to transition dress codes and transition bathrooms.
I wanted to ask you about public accommodations. As you said, this is sort of the next step that you're hoping for. Have you developed a kind of strategy for how you want to take this part now of the issue on?
I mean, I think that our strategy is always going to be consistent. It's unfortunate that people attach the word compromise so much to this law, because Equality Utah will never compromise its commitment to equality, as the name suggests. So we won't accept any special rules that apply only to LGBT people, any specific exemptions. In general, we're going to have to be opposed to exemptions for religious individuals or businesses owned by religious people who would seek a right to discriminate in the name of religious freedom. We think that's a distortion of what religious freedom means. And we think that most Americans agree with us on that.
Do you have any sense what may happen with hate crimes legislation now? I mean, if the resistance in the past has been, you know, mentioning sexual orientation as some kind of slippery slope to same-sex marriage and adoption, well, if now that you have those things out of the way, or probably shortly, or I think if people assume that that will be out of the way, do you think this could clear the way forward to hate crimes or a stronger hate crime bill or law in this state?
Absolutely. I'm very optimistic that we can work together to get hate crimes legislation passed in our state. Several years ago, there was a proposal to name the kinds of hate, which would lead to enhancements for violent crimes. And the legislature resisted naming any classifications because they didn't want to add sexual orientation in particular to the Utah Code. Now, of course, it appears in the Utah Code, so the resistance to that particular symbol probably goes away. And as you said, the general notion of sexual orientation becoming a protected class for purposes of marriage and adoption is either already resolved in Utah or soon will be resolved nationwide by the United States Supreme Court. And there's really no religious liberty issue when it comes to hate crimes, right? That no one believes that crime should be committed in the name of religious belief or for any other reason. So I think the issues there are easier to manage.
What do you think is next in this issue for now? And what are you hearing within the LGBT community? As we've talked about, there were some who think they invoked that word compromise. They think that too much was compromised. I mean, what's your sense of what might be next in this issue as you look at it?
Well, I mean, I think you've hit the two major issues, right in the head. That is to say, reforming our hate crimes law, which is deeply problematic right now. The way it has been written, people are unable to charge hate crimes. There was a horrific act of violence against a gay couple in Salt Lake City within the last year, and the Salt Lake District Attorney was not able to charge it as a hate crime because of the problems with the hate crimes law, although he wanted to. So that's certainly an issue coming up. And as you said, public accommodations, laws that require a business that opens itself up to the public to serve all comers, to serve all customers, without discriminating based on certain traits. So those are the obvious issues. From what I've heard, of course, there are always critics outside of Utah. Equality and common ground can in some ways be a lonely place to be. There are folks that believe that even saying the word compromise is always the wrong move. And they, living in places like New York and San Francisco, could wait a very long time indeed before the Utah legislature passes such a law as this. But there are unemployed, homeless LGBT Utahns who deeply needed these protections. And we were able to find a way to support them without compromising our fundamental principles. And, we're very proud of that. It's also true, as I'm sure you'll hear, that the LDS Church is now getting criticism from evangelical Christians in other states who believe that they have made compromises, quote, that are inappropriate.
Cliff Roski, law professor at the University of Utah, chairman of the Board of Equality Utah, joined us from the Brookings Institution. He's there in Washington, D.C. today. Professor, thanks again for the time.
Thank you so much.
We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Observers are calling the coming together of Utah's LGBT community and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in support of a bill that protects LGBT people, but also provides religious freedom protections historic. And we're talking about it today, telling some of the backstory to that bill and what happens next. Joining us now on the program is Michael Purdy. He's Director of Government Relations for The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And Michael Purdy, welcome back to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
What can you say about how the church, Jennifer Doudna's story, I think, is instructive. She talked about the fact that Jim DeBacchus made, in the 1990s, made attempts to talk to church leaders, send them letters, get them to come to the table to see what kind of negotiation could, and that didn't work at first, and then things, what was the real change in terms of the church being willing to come to the table to talk about this? How are you explaining how that sort of played out?
Well, I think over time with any big issue, you always see an evolution of thought, of understanding of issues, of people knowing each other better, of details being filled in. But specifically now, people talk about this, kind of coming out of the blue this year. And in some ways, I guess that's true, but in many other ways, not. I mean, these kind of conversations have been happening for some time to try to deal with, the issues that society faces in this community and different stakeholders having a role in that. And I think in this particular instance, church leaders saw this collision course that had been developing and actually taking place in other states, where so many people looked at this religious freedom issues and non-discrimination issues as something that one side had to win and the other side had to lose. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of this zero-sum game of, who's going to win and who's going to lose that just seemed, I think, ridiculous. At some point it was, isn't there another way? And so, when church leaders held this press conference at the end of January, right, and said, called on lawmakers to look for that other way, to look for a different solution where, some discussions could happen, where collaboration could take place, a little bit of compromise. And, aren't we much better off as a society and as institutions and as individuals when, if everybody can get 95% rather than, some group getting 100% and somebody getting nothing, isn't everybody better off in that situation? And so I think that was the catalyst for this discussion.
Was it much of a sell to lawmakers? I mean, you have 85% plus members of the legislature who are LDS. But they were wondering what to do. I mean, they were hearing this support for this piece of legislation from their church, but they also had, their own ideological positions, their own public conscience positions, I suppose. Was that a difficult sell, I guess? I'm not sure, that sounds crass, I suppose, to put it that way, but you did have four lobbyists up there, and I guess you probably always do. But what was that process like, if you can explain that?
Well, I don't think difficult sell is the way to say it, but I mean, obviously these are difficult issues.
Sure.
And as you said, people were, people across the nation are looking for answers. They're looking for solutions to, as I said before, something that's always been seen as two ideologies on a collision course. Yeah. And is there an answer? That typically to me seems to have been what the question was before. Is there an answer? I think church leaders always felt like there had to be an answer, and that answer was in when people come together and look for some solution that provides this balanced approach, this fairness for all, rather than winner take all. And so I think lawmakers in this state and in a number of other places have been looking for some opening like that that looked like there was a path forward besides the collision course. So, all in all, I think the feelings of goodwill in these discussions, they were certainly difficult discussions and many long discussions, but they were always characterized by this feeling of goodwill and let's find a solution.
The church has been quite concerned over the years that religious liberties are being threatened. It's been expressed, Elder Dallin Oaks is one who's been quite vocal about this. And you, in fact, yourself, in statements have mentioned that there have been many examples of religious freedoms being overturned. Could you be specific about what it is you worry about in regards to the threats to religious liberty?
Mm. I think there's two main classifications of that. There's certainly institutional religious freedoms that are important. I mean, churches need to be able to act and function as churches and to teach their doctrine and to offer their sacraments and to do the things that churches do. So that the freedom for the institutional church and other churches to be able to do that is critical in society. And I think everybody understands that. And then there's religious freedoms of individuals.
And that's the part you worry about?
Well, I think you have to worry about both.
Sure.
Because they're both critical. But you know, I think one of the overarching concerns has been by some this idea that religious freedom was something where you could go into a church on Sunday and you know worship how you want and believe what you want, but to bring those beliefs into practice in your life outside of that religious setting was something that was unacceptable. I think that ought to be a concern to everybody. I mean, ultimately, what everybody brings to the public square is some set of beliefs. And some people may call those religious beliefs, and other people would characterize them as something different. But it's still belief that drives you, your opinion and your views and your vote. And to see that silenced in some way is I think, short-sighted.
Oh, and by silenced, I guess one of the things that you saw clearly that concerned you, people in relationship to this Prop 8 argument in California, people who are expressing their religious views related to same-sex marriage, supporting the effort for Proposition 8, were being retaliated against. In some cases, they lost their jobs or certainly business opportunities.
Right.
That was one of the things that you were worried about.
Of course, of course. I mean, what's more democratic than people bringing those views, whatever the genesis of them, and into the public square and working towards a cause that they believe in and ultimately casting a vote for something that they think is important. When that's criticized for whatever reason, I think everybody loses.
Mormon historian Greg Prince told Jennifer Dobner of the Tribune that the church's battle against same-sex marriage in general and their involvement in your involvement in Prop 8 in particular disenfranchised large numbers of church members. Is that true?
I don't think so. I guess you'd have to wonder what large means. You know, I don't know how to quantify that. But I think one of the things that's misunderstood about Prop 8 is that somehow the church felt it was a mistake to get into that, and any effort since then has been some attempt to make up for that.
There's a lot of people saying that,
yeah,
but, and you say
yeah.
That's not true at
yeah,
all.
Yeah, I don't believe there's a lot of validity to that, except maybe to the degree that as time goes on, there's more understanding and there's more communication and there's more knowledge about a particular issue. But Prop 8, I think, is important to remember, was about marriage. And I think because it was about marriage and kind of this overarching principle, that some people put a lot of things under that umbrella that really didn't have a lot to do with marriage. So while the church was and still does have a doctrine on marriage that isn't changing, right after that, church leaders were able to support the Salt Lake Ordinance.
But of course, people didn't have anything to do with marriage. But they say the reason you did that was because you were facing a backlash, both from members of the church, but also outside. And so you had to do something. So you supported the Salt Lake Ordinance.
Yeah. Like I said, I think it may be a convenient thing for people, but they're two very different issues. And while the church was calling for, a definition of marriage that was important and doctrinal to the church, we were also calling for civility constantly and talking about respect for others who had differing views and, calling for dialogue on these issues and keeping that, at least attempting to keep that discussion about marriage particularly and not some of the other things that seem to fall under that.
Another question that came up is what you're hearing from members of the church who have gay children or people in their family who are represent or part of the LGBT community. Is the church hearing from the families of gay Latter-day Saints, and is that influencing this process in some way as well?
I think church leaders are hearing from families and from members across the spectrum on all kinds of issues. I mean, for someone to think that these conversations aren't taking place in a global organization, I think is just fallacy. These are issues of importance to society and of importance to people and therefore of importance to the church.
I wonder, does this, you've mentioned, and I think it's been pretty clear from church leaders that you're not going to be budging doctrinally on this issue. And you've said in statements that the church remains strongly committed to marriage between a man and a woman. As the only marriage consistent with the laws of God, It says in your Mormonnewsroom.org that the commandment and doctrine that marriage is between a man and a woman comes from sacred scripture. Could you lay that out for me? Like, where does it say that? What does it say in Mormon scripture that says marriage is only between a man and a woman? I'm sure that's a very clear position within the church, but what are you drawing on beyond just modern-day revelation or the comments from modern-day leaders?
Well, I think you could point to Adam and Eve in the scriptures and how they were joined together and formed that first marriage, that first family. And, the New Testament speaks very plainly about a man and a woman being joined together and not being put asunder. So there's multiple references to that. And so I think it's very clear, as you've said, the church isn't changing its doctrine on marriage, its position on marriage, and a belief that definition of marriage is good for society, good for children. But having that position doesn't mean something like non-discrimination ordinances can't take place. They're different things.
For the LGBT community, there are still a few loose ends, of course, that they wanted to tie up about all of this. One of them, of course, is protections for the LGBT people in the marketplace. That you're not allowed to be deprived of goods and services because you represent a particular sexual orientation. The church has said that in your statement that public accommodation part of this bill was just too divisive to find a middle ground at this time. So, are you hopeful are you going to be negotiating about that? Where is the church's position related to a public accommodations bill that will clearly come up and probably next year?
Yeah, I think everybody understands it'll come up at some point and probably sooner rather than later. But at this point, everybody agreed that it was more of a barrier to getting some very good things accomplished, and there wasn't a lot of development of that common ground that you just referenced. And so it wasn't something that was pursued this year. It will come up again. And I think what's necessary for really productive dialogue on these kind of topics is a more full understanding of what the issues really are. I mean, some people try to categorize public accommodation as simply, someone serving a hamburger. And I guess it's in its most basic form you could make that case. But really, you're talking about, what role does a government coerce people into doing certain things? And what is fair for everybody? And that'll be the discussion that has to happen. And I'm hopeful that, with the process that I hope Utah showed in this legislative session that would be a model for others to follow, that there's a template there of discussion and respect and understanding and a real vetting of the issues in their deepest sense and not just superficially, and some good outcomes, some good solutions can be found.
Is it too early to say that the LDS Church right now is officially opposed to a public accommodations component to this?
No, I wouldn't say that. But the detail is what matters. And at what point, you saw that in this process too. People can agree readily on broad principles, but when you get down to the how does this really happen?
Yeah.
And then it gets really nitty gritty and tends to go to the extremes, maybe, unfortunately, the what if situations and the unintended consequence. And everybody can come up with a scenario that says, I couldn't live with that. And it may be the one in a trillion scenario, but when you're talking about putting something into law, that becomes a big deal. And so those conversations have to happen, and they can be very difficult because of those, the what ifs.
Yeah.
But I think there's a lot of hope on all sides that reasonable solutions can be found.
Have you had any discussion about a hate crimes bill, for example? That's another one of those little pieces that I think the LGBT community would love to tie up, is to give a little bit more teeth to a hate crimes bill law.
Yeah, I heard Cliff talk about that previously, and that's not something that I've been involved in or that we've played much of a role in to date, and maybe that will be something in the future. I don't know, but to date it hasn't been.
It's interesting. KUTV asked a really good question to Elder Christofferson. How does religious freedom apply to members of the LDS Church? Can members support same-sex marriage and still be members in good standing, for example? What's the answer to that?
Well, I think Elder Christofferson gave the answer when he talked about there's a diversity of view on any given topic when you have 15 million members of a faith, you know, living globally. And so that's, of course, those different views are accommodated. You know, the problem, you know, you get into is when, you know, what does that look like in publicly? And you know, is what form does that differing view take?
So if they go out and attack the church, for example, or that could be a problem.
Right.
But if they just hold this position privately, so they can do it. They can have their own opinion related to same-sex marriage, and let's say it's in support of same-sex marriage, and still remain members in good standing of the LDS faith.
Right. And I think whenever you've heard the church talk about these issues, it's always recognized that people will have differing views, and that these can be difficult issues. They can be divisive, but to try to bridge that divisiveness to the degree possible, with understanding that that's just a reality, and then you know, calling for that civility in the dialogue that surrounds that has always been very important to church leaders. And when that happens, there's really not many problems.
Let me ask you finally, what are you hearing from within the church itself? What kind of reaction are you getting? I mean, I think a lot of people think, well, the church says something, everyone gets in line. But are you getting any pushback? Are you getting, you must be hearing a great deal of support for your role in this process as well.
Yeah, I think everybody's really happy about the end result for all the reasons we've talked about, because a solution was found that was very different, a whole different approach than what we've seen typically when these issues have been brought up, both in Utah and in other states. So I think that's something that everybody involved can be very pleased with, and certainly the churches too. Church members, I think, have been overwhelmingly supportive of what happened. You know, we knew going in that there would be, you know, people on the far right and on the far left, as there are in any issue, that would not like everything about what was accomplished in this legislative session. But there's that large group in the middle that are looking for solutions and practical solutions and ways for people to get along and to exist respectfully and peacefully together, that are very pleased. And I think most church members fall into that category as well.
It's Michael Purdy, Director of Government Relations for The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Mr. Purdy, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.